listen, this is a craft. Business is a craft, and I am an apprentice under some amazing business people that are constantly trying to figure it out. But I don't think there's an end game here. It's really a system of systems that we're just constantly trying to refine and get better and learn and evolve and grow. The really amazing people in life treat their life's work as a craft. You can have a job, and I think that's cool. You can have a passion, that's a little bit better. But you can also have a calling. And I think the people that are really obsessed with it, like Darcy said in his interview, he'll never retire. I'll never retire. Mm-hmm. Retire from what? Mm-hmm. I love this. I will do this my whole life. Yeah. This is what I do. I am a craftsman. Mm-hmm. And it's just this constant evolution of trying to get better and better at what I love to do.
Welcome to the Calgary Sessions. This is episode number 122. I'm your host, Jeff Humphreys. Before we get into it, just a small ask. I'm trying to get some more exposure around this thing. So if you could leave a review or subscribe to it, those are kind of my two asks right now. So I'd appreciate it. Today's guest, our buddy, Mitch Jacobson, did the intro here. And I asked Mitch, I'm like, you know, do you know anybody in your world that would be good on the show? And right away, he put your name up. So I'm pumped to get into this. Our little bullshit before we started was fun too. So please name and who you are.
Hey, I'm so excited to be 122. Name is Chad Hayden and I'm a serial entrepreneur.
Dude, it's great. That was like, well, you listened to Darcy's.
And I copied it. Ripped it off. I think Darcy's great.
Yeah, and you guys are kind of like in the same tech, like.
Oh, I admire Darcy. Yeah, okay. When I grow up, that's who I want to be for sure.
Dude, me too. yeah, man, this would be a really cool one. I don't do any research on anybody, so I have a loose idea of kind of what you've built and what you're up to, but I'm really curious to hear about the story. So, hey man, wind it back. Take me back to kind of how you grew up, where you grew up, you know, how your parents or family inspired you. Just we'll kind of walk our way to where you are today, and I'm just going to pepper you with questions.
So I was born on a Tuesday, October 5th, 1987. It was rainy. No, I'm just kidding. Born in Calgary. Awesome.
Oh, cool.
Spent a couple of my formative years in Calgary. Yep. Not really. I think I was two or three. Mm. We moved to Medicine Hat. So step one, moved to Medicine Hat. I grew up in town in Medicine Hat for a handful of years. And I think grade five, we moved out to an acreage just outside of Medicine Hat in a place called Dunmore. There's a trend here. I've moved a lot. My dad was an operator and worked at plants across Alberta. So that led us to Medicine Hat. He worked in a methanol plant, sort of in Medicine Hat. Mm. Grew up on an acreage, went to a school where there was 20 people in my whole grade. Being the city kid, moving out to a farm where everybody showed up in sort of boots and jeans. Yeah, that was pretty wild for me, but I think that left me with an understanding that you can reinvent yourself, right?
Yeah.
If I look back on my school pictures, it's absolutely hilarious. You've got all these kids in cowboy hats and Wranglers and boots. And then you've got me with frosted tips and a puka shell necklace and a vest and cords. Yeah, trying to be hip and cool. But
Do you think you were going out of your way to kind of find your like style? Because you're surrounded by a bunch of this like Western culture. Were you kind of trying to figure it out on your own?
Put yourself in a different environment, moving down to Medicine Hat and then out into a farm and acreage, me being this kid that would read, the GQ magazine and trying to be hip and trendy and was into music. Yeah, it was totally out of my element, but that afforded me the ability to learn how to recreate myself. And what I do today as a CEO of a company, as a business builder, as an entrepreneur, is this constant reinvention. And I think it probably started there. It was a neat opportunity. From there, my family started, the methanol plant went down. They mothballed one of the towers.
Okay.
And part of the severance was, we'll either give you this severance or we'll give you money to start a business. And I remember my parents thinking about this and going, yeah, let's be entrepreneurs and let's start a business. So that was pretty neat. So my formative years when I was younger, I watched my parents start an all-year-round driving range in Medicine Hat.
No way.
And in theory, it sounds great, right? You've got hockey heaters. What Topgolf is today, many years ago, I watched them 2000s, early 2000s. Being somebody who was young, my mom ran the kitchen and that side of it. My dad built the thing and ran the operations and kept the balls going. I got to be around that. So I got to watch my parents be entrepreneurs very early on, and that was super cool. Lots of sacrifices. I've got a little brother and a little sister. And, you know, while my mom was running the kitchen, my dad was keeping everything going. I was, you know, hanging out with my brother and sister and making sure that they didn't burn the house down. So it was pretty cool.
That operating piece, your dad on these, obviously what you're, the space you're in now. Was it shift work back then?
Absolutely. Yeah. It was shift work.
I'll give you this random, like reference point in my life. I worked at the Mazeppa gas plant for a summer. And so what I did, I was like drive around all the sites to south of Calgary, but you know, we'd have to go to the plant every morning. So I started to, I was hanging out with operators. And you know, they worked their 12s or 8s or whatever. And you know, there's just, it seems like such a, I remember going into the operation room for the first time. It just looked like this. It almost looked like that Simpson kind of.
Like Homer that. Spinning around his chair.
All these screens and like anyways, that when you said operator, I was like, oh man. I just like flashback to that moment.
My grandpa, Howard, was an operator at the Mazeppa gas plant. So you probably crossed paths with him years ago. Small world.
So I would have been, another random story. I was coaching this all-star team. This Adam, they were going to Pee-wee. And I was coaching this all-star, Southern Alberta Selects all-star team. And one of the kids on the team, his dad owned a plant. And we had like a family connection to him. So anyways, he's like, do you want to coach? I'm like, well, I need a summer job. So I ended
up line it up.
I met it was at Mazeppa. And this is probably, I don't know, man, late 90s? Early 2000s.
That's cool.
Random.
Shift work. So like, I remember my dad having like tin foiled windows. He would, when he was off shift and it was daytime, he'd sleep in the basement. And us being hooligans, we'd be knocking tennis balls off his window. He'd come out yelling at us. Just what you do when you have a parent that works shift work. But I think that teaches kids adversity, right? It teaches kids that a little bit of sacrifice, a little bit of hard work, a little bit of grit and tenacity is actually good. And you have to work hard in life to get to where you're going.
And it's, and I think it also shows you that there's a different way to do it. You know what I mean? Like just because everyone else goes and punches it nine to five, there's a different way and a different approach.
Well, we'll get there. I've worked my fair years of shift work in my life in some pretty wild situations, but I think it made me not afraid of that. Not afraid to go to these crazy places and do things that, you know, people on the outside perceive to be crazy. It's just what's normal to me growing up.
Seeing your parents kind of build a business. Did you kind of, were you old enough to kind of really understand what was happening, like the risk they were taking and the amount of work they were putting in?
Well, I come from a family of entrepreneurs. So my grandfather on my mother's side is a land developer and was always, you know, into some sort of crazy business. On my dad's side, I've got a couple uncles who started their own companies and built them into billion-dollar businesses. So, you know, part of this was, I thought this is what everybody does. Everybody starts to create their own businesses and be their own boss. The driving range didn't work out. I watched my parents go through starting this business and getting it to a point where it just didn't make sense for us anymore. And my dad had to take a job up in Fort McMurray and we moved again. I would have been in grade eight. Now I'm dressing like a cowboy. And we moved to Sherwood Park. So I go from the city to the country, and now I'm coming back to the city. And guess what? I show up in my Wranglers and my cowboy boots. And everybody's wearing their Adidas. And I'm going like, whoa, this is crazy. I'm back.
Great. It all comes full circle.
So we moved to Sherwood Park. I went from having 20 people in my class to having, you know, 300 people in my grade. Whoa, this is crazy. I got to reinvent myself again. I've lived in probably 20 houses my whole life. So this iteration or this, you know, like comfort in not having what people would perceive as like that family house that's been around forever, that safety. You know, I don't need that feeling. I'm not scared of that. Something new, moving, reinventing yourself. That actually gets me excited. That's really cool.
Did you, like grade eight, like when you're moving around as a youngster, you know, you're losing friends, but you're not like that. You're not rooted in these communities yet.
Yeah.
The older you get and you keep on bouncing around, did it, you know, when you're walking into these schools, what's your tone? Like, what's your attitude like?
Oh, I had to figure that out for sure. Yeah. One, it's like blend and fit in. But we had MSN Messenger. So when I moved, you know, the first move, I don't really remember that, out from Medicine Hat out to the farm, I joined like the student council sort of thing. And, you know, I kind of got in, found my friends group, and there's only 20 people in your class. So
yeah,
you figure it out. And I made some really good friends there. But my friends from Medicine Hat, they just live a different life than we did in the big city, or we do now in Calgary. All of those friends got married really early. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm mid-30s and I have friends who are grandparents, which is wild to think about. So it was just a different cadence or a different life pace that they were on. And yeah, it was really neat to experience that. And I had so much fun living down there. Moving to a place like Sherwood Park was an awakening that, like, holy smokes, the world is big. You know, yeah, my circle of influence, the people around me, it goes from being 20 kids to being a couple hundred kids. I joined a bunch of sports teams because we didn't really have sports living on the farm. We had hockey. Mm-hmm. We had the keys to the arena. We literally used to, like, at lunchtime, we'd leave our hockey bags in the arena and we'd go skate for lunch. Like, that's all we did. It was great. Had a heck of a hockey team. Get a bunch of farm kids together.
Yeah, I hated playing small town.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah. But moving to Sherwood Park, I got to play new sports and meet new people and really see this diversity of sort of what was happening in a bigger ecosystem. So it was pretty cool. Mm. I got to reinvent myself again.
The sport piece, was it something you're interested in and also just like to kind of throw yourself into these new situations and community?
Yeah, honestly, not really whatsoever. My dad was a pretty good hockey player. Okay. He played a few games in the WHL and would travel around playing on different hockey teams and baseball teams. And growing up and hearing those stories about my dad in Medicine Hat, this local legend, hearing those stories, I would always compare myself to my dad. And it got to the point when I moved in sort of that grade eight, that formative years, when I moved to the city, the teams were already selected. These kids have been playing together since they were 6 years old. I was the new guy. So I had to find sports that were new to me. So I joined the football. I joined the volleyball team and the football team. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Random.
Well, I played baseball my whole life, so I could throw a ball pretty well. I didn't even know how to put on football gear. I remember being in the locker room the first time, looking around at everybody, being like, all right, what's happening?
Cool. What's next?
I went out there and was just running around the field and I ended up grabbing a ball and throwing it back to the quarterback. And the one coach walks over to me and goes, hey, you're now a quarterback. You threw that ball better than he does. So it's like, holy smokes. So I got into that and rode that out through high school, made some pretty good friends and relationships there. But yeah, I've never really thought of, I'm not an athlete. Mm-hmm. I'm more of a mathlete and live, you know, I think of my body as a way to carry my brain around from meeting to meeting.
Have you always thought that? Have you? I guess back it all up, but like coming through school, smart. Like, did you always know that? Like, your mind
Hell
is your.
No, I don't think I'm smart. Just like Darcy said in his podcast, my differentiators that I'll outwork anybody. I'm not smarter than anybody. I'm charismatic. I care. I'm curious. But my real trait that differentiates me from everyone else is that I just will outwork or outthink anybody. I obsess over things where I can really get into a mindset where I really understand and I'm forever curious. So that's sort of where I live. When I transferred from Medicine Hat to this school in Sherwood Park, I had the grades to go into this IB program.
Oh, yeah, I remember. They still have IB, but yeah.
I lasted like a half a semester and like, these are the nerds. Get me out of here. I'm not interested in this whatsoever. So I'm a kind of a C guy and that's okay. I actually think the best leaders in life sort of fly around that sort of, you know, A's when you want to and you're interested in it and C's for the rest of them. That's kind of where I fit.
So was high school pretty mellow time, like playing football, doing anything else? Like, and were you guys settled at this point? Like, was this going to be a spot you're going to be at for a few years? Or are you always like looking over your shoulder, wondering when you're going to move?
Yeah, I think by this time it wasn't, you know, a move to me wasn't a big deal, but this is where I went from grade 8 to sort of grade 12. Mm. The day after I graduated high school, I left and went and worked on an oil rig. Mm. So
And what was the push? Like, why?
Well, I've seen so many of these kids, older kids, brothers and sisters that would just stick around and continue to be like they're living in high school. They'd have the same friends group doing the same thing. And I'm like, whoa, I don't want to do that. Like, I like adventure. I like sort of finding the next thing. And to me, I had a couple uncles who worked in oil and gas, and I didn't really know if I wanted to go to school or anything. And one of them said, like, hey, why don't you go do some hard work for a couple years? And importantly, figure out what you want to do. But most importantly, figure out what you don't want to do. So 17-year-old, I went out to a rig, and hilarious story. So very first rig I ever went to was in Drumheller, and it's in the middle of a farmer's field. And when you go out to a rig, they have these things called lease roads.
Dude,
you've been there?
Worked on a rig.
Oh, yeah. Okay, cool. So I get told, okay, you're going to go out to Trailblazer 26 and we're drilling out by Carbon by Drumheller. And I can see the rig. I can't find a road to get in there. I'm driving a Jeep. I just booted across the farmer's field. Like, literally turn off the highway and just
straight line
pin her to the rig, which is like an absolute do not do this. Do not pass go.
Mm-hmm.
I remember rolling onto lease, and I parked beside all the rest of the trucks, and the company man comes out and is like, who are you and what are you doing? I'm like, I'm about to drill an oil well. Who are you and what are you doing? So that was quite the adventure.
At that age,
yeah,
to be in that environment, there's a lot going on.
Yeah, you know, you go out there as a 17-year-old kid, you think you're cool, coming out of high school, played on the football team, puka shell necklace, and all of a sudden you get out there with men and you're like, whoa, this is wild. Mm-hmm. I remember my first hitch. The guys that smoke got to go out to the flare stack and have a cigarette. So the company man goes, hey, I'm going into town. You want a pack of smokes? I said, yeah, I want a pack of smokes. And he goes, what do you smoke? So I don't know. Just give me whatever you get. And he goes, no, what kind? And I go, I didn't know any kinds. I had no fucking idea. I never smoked a cigarette in my life. So the company man says, okay. He goes into town. He comes back and he gives me this green pack of smokes. And he goes, let's go have a smoke. Okay. So I get out to the flare stack with him and I'm looking at these cigarettes and the ends look the same. I've seen movies. One side should be white. The other side should be brown. Right? He bought me straight up cigarettes. So I didn't last long smoking, but I got an extra break to hang out with the guys. But yeah, you go out there as a 17-year-old kid. I didn't last very long, maybe a year and a half. And then I ended up going to school. I went to took petroleum engineering at SATE.
When you're out there for a year and a half,
yeah,
are you like giving it thought? Like, you know, when you're dealing with, I'm sure you're like, what was the bottom guy's name that just cleaned all the time?
Lee Sand. That was me. Yeah.
Yeah. You do that for
a
duration of time. And are you at the end of that nozzle thinking about what you want to do with your life?
Yeah. Thinking I don't want to be here. I'm going to come back one day and fire all these guys on this rig.
Yeah.
I used to do this thing where I'd sit on a pail. I put a pail down and then I put my hard hat on the wall and I'd sleep. So I go find like a compressor building or a pump and just sit there and sleep. And I remember one time I woke up, my boss had took a lit cigarette and put it in the back pocket of my coveralls. Just things like that, right? Yeah. You get this adversity, but eventually become part of that team. And as scary as that team was when I got out there and I thought they were, you know, trying to kill me. And it was crazy. When I left that rig, those guys would do anything for me. Mm-hmm. And to have that camaraderie, like we were through some wild situations with, you know, guys on the rigs, partners, chaos, life. You become part of that. You're spending so much time together, sleeping in the same hotel rooms. Yeah, that was really cool.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciated that sort of time of my life, as hard as it was.
Yeah. And so why the pull to petroleum engineering?
Well, I'm far too handsome to work in a rig my whole life. Obviously, humble.
Good thing we brought the good cameras today.
No, I just think, you know, as much as it was for me to go out there and get some hard work, it was make me realize that, hey, there's some people that do this their whole life because that's all they've got. You know, the rest of it is hard to get.
Yep.
So I went through that and I've always been curious about building things, and working on a rig was a really cool opportunity to figure out what was happening. You know, when we set casing, when we pump cement into the ground, I was always sort of in the doghouse asking the engineers out there, like, what's going on? What are we doing? Why are we doing this? Yep. Sort of that curiosity. So,
and the energy space was like interesting to you?
Yeah, my whole family are in energy. Mm. My dad was an operator. My grandpa at the Mazeppa gas plant. Mm. I've got a couple uncles who are in it.
Yeah.
When I think about energy and Western Canada, it's afforded us such amazing luxuries. When you think about the wealth that it's brought into Calgary, it's fed into, you know, oil companies paying taxes, which supports healthcare, which supports education, all of these very important things to do.
Yeah.
We're in such a great space in Western Canada, and my whole family is in that. So I said, yeah, why not? Let's give it a go.
And so once you get there, like, did you have an idea? I know nothing about the program, but like, do you kind of know what the out looks like? Like what you're going to come out with? And did you have an idea where you're going to go?
Yeah. So while I was going to school, I worked for a drilling fluids company. So I would also write mud programs. So when you work on the rigs, you pump this fluid down the drill bit and it's used to circulate the cuttings out of the well and keep the well from shooting gas and oil into space.
Yep.
And so I actually sort of worked while I was going to school, which was cool because I had worked on the rigs and I understood it. Now I was sort of applying that and learning about it in school. Yeah, it was awesome. Mm. I had a ton of fun and I've always been curious. So I've wanted to see different places and I was always willing to jump in a truck and go to facilities or out in the field or to these new rigs. It was awesome. I learned a lot.
And just natural, hey? Like you'd bounced around so much that kind of without knowing it, you probably just were comfortable in that kind of situation.
Yeah. When your parents are entrepreneurs, like Mitch talked about in his podcast, I would always go around with, like when my parents were building the driving range, I was there with them doing it, figuring it out, new problems every day, hanging out with my grandparents and sort of my uncles. It's just sort of what I didn't think about it as crazy. I would, if somebody was like, Chad, I got the keys, we got to go to this and do this. Yeah, I'm in, let's go. We'll figure it out. Mm. It doesn't really scare. In fact, it excites me, and I've learned to look for that.
Yep.
But yeah, I think I learned that when I was when I was young. This is normal to me, and I don't think it's normal to everybody.
No, I agree. Did your parents ever talk to you about it, like starting, like doing your own thing, or did you guys have those kind of conversations around the dinner table as they're kind of building out the driving range?
Well, so many people in my family are entrepreneurs. Thanksgiving dinner is almost like a board meeting where it's like, hey, update, what are you doing? What are you working on? How's business? Where are you going? Mm. What's next? What do you need help with?
Just around it.
Yeah, we're around it, right? And my parents, you know, starting a business, having the business fail, going through all of that, having those conversations, seeing your parents work hard, it becomes normal. I don't think it's something that they ever hid from us, but we were there living it beside them for sure.
So you go to school, graduate. Was that a 4-year thing?
2 years. 2 years, thankfully.
Yep.
So in 2 years, you graduate with an engineering technology diploma. Most of my friends went off to engineering school. I went on my next great adventure. So that company that I worked for, writing mud programs, there was an opportunity to go to Denver. Mm. Check that out. Mm-hmm. I went down there for a couple weeks to help them with a few things and ended up staying for the better part of 2 years.
Wow.
That was pretty neat.
And again, just comfortable in the new environment. And
I lived in a hotel like Richie Rich for 2 years.
No way.
It was cool.
You really enjoyed that?
So I loved it.
My rig thing was like, I think it was like maybe a month.
Yeah.
But living in that fucking hotel and some small, I don't like hotels at the best of times. So like, I can imagine living in one for that duration of time.
Oh, I'll tell you a story about when I got offshore, cause that takes it to a whole new level. But
so the job in Denver, like you just see an opportunity, you're willing to go check it out. Like the curiosity piece, like you said, you just,
I'm a fixer. Mm. So when I sit on top of, when somebody says, hey, Chad, I have a problem, I'm going to figure out a way to solve the problem. Mm. And if I sit on top of it long enough, we'll come up with a pretty good solution and we'll get it off to the races and I go off and try to find my next thing to fix. Mm. So this company had started an office in Denver and they were really trying to get their systems and process and spreadsheets, everything up to speed. And I went down there and started to help them solve some problems and would bounce from problem to problem to problem. Until this same company did an acquisition in Texas And I got the opportunity to go down there. They said, hey, Chad, you know, Denver's cool, but do you want to go check out Texas? And I said, yeah, but you got to buy me an apartment because I don't want to live in a hotel anymore. This is crazy. So went and spent 4 years in Houston working for a fellow named Richard Baxter, who I absolutely admire, but he is also a fixer. And Baxter and I would go off. I was sort of his sidekick on his six, and we go off and get into the craziest situations and fix really hard problems. So I had so much fun. I learned so much. I have so many crazy stories, but it was an awesome 4 years.
Did you, this idea around like fixing problem solving, did you always know that was a thing, or were you thrown in situations where you were accomplishing things and all of a sudden it became this talent that you didn't know you had?
Yeah, I've been a builder. I've always liked Lego. We grew up sort of on an acreage where going to town was a pain. So you made do with what you had. My grandpa lives on a farm and would fix equipment before he'd ever buy anything. So I think I just grew up with the mentality that you got to figure this out. You got to fix it with what you've got. I remember my grandpa had this encyclopedia set of engineering where you could go in and see how a transmission worked or a carburetor, all these sorts of things. And you know, before you took your car to the shop, you'd give it a go and try to fix it. So that's sort of what I grew up with. And I think of business the same way too.
Yep.
When you sit on top of a problem and think really hard about it and let your mind sort of wander, you look for patterns. And once you start to see the patterns, you can reassemble the pieces in sort of this harmonious way that results in a really cool solution.
Did you, how long did it take you to figure that out? You know, the way you just articulated that, you kind of...
I haven't figured it out.
how long has it taken you to get to this point where you're able to like understand how you operate?
Listen, this is a craft. Business is a craft, and I am an apprentice under some amazing business people that are constantly trying to figure it out, but I don't think there's an end game here. Yeah. It's really a system of systems that we're just constantly trying to refine and get better and learn and evolve and grow. You know, the really amazing people in life treat their life's work as a craft. You know, you can have a job, and I think that's cool. You can have a passion, that's a little bit better. But you can also have a calling. And I think the people that are really obsessed with it, like Darcy said in his interview, he'll never retire. I'll never retire. Mm-hmm. Retire from what? Mm-hmm. I love this. I will do this my whole life. Yeah. This is what I do. I am a craftsman. And it's just this constant evolution of trying to get better and better at what I love to do.
Yeah, such as that craftsman piece, it's an interesting way to look at it. I've never heard the word used before.
Yeah, it's a craft. And when you think of, it took me a while to realize that business is a craft and process is a craft and systems are a craft. And to get incredibly good at it, it takes a long time. And it's, you know, it's this constant pursuit of perfection, but you never get there.
Yeah,
you just continually get better and refine that process.
What happens in Houston or coming out of Houston? Where's your...
Well, I just had too much fun.
Like, was Houston a... Houston, you've kind of gotten a rhythm and...
Yeah, Houston was so cool. I actually had to move. Like, I had to leave Canada and go through all the paperwork to become a U.S. resident and do all the stuff with taxes. Yep. And, you know, that's part of growing up and something I wasn't scared about. We figured it out. But spent 4 years in Texas, and it took me to Penn State University, where I worked on a couple projects, to South Texas, doing some really cool things on the King Ranch. I got to go offshore in the Gulf of Mexico. It was really this crazy adventure with exposure to things that not a lot of people get to see. Doing that at a young age with somebody who was that master craftsman, this Richard Baxter fellow was this true master craftsman. Man, I learned so much so fast. When you can apprentice under somebody who is really that master craftsman, it pulls you sort of up to their level hyper quickly.
Did you know that was kind of the idea, or did you feel it? Did you fully understand what kind of situation you're walking into?
I know it now for sure, but I think that was really my first time working with somebody that was on that caliber, just world-class caliber, and it made me go so incredibly quick to try to keep up. just the thought and the intensity and the understanding to try to keep up with Richard was wildly fascinating. I learned so much. I'm so thankful for that period and really kind of set me on the trajectory to go look for that next master craftsman to apprentice under.
So 4 years, 4 years in, what's the thing that made you go look somewhere else?
Well, I think at some point, you know, you live somewhere far away from your family. It's time to come home.
You realize that, hey, like that was...
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was time. I had a couple little cousins that were sort of growing up in their formative years and we come home and I have so much fun with them. But at that point in my life, I had made so much money and worked so hard. I took an entire summer off. I think I moved back from Houston in April and didn't actually get a real job until November, December. I moved to Kelowna. Mm. I rented an apartment. This guy had this apartment that he rented to students, and the students were obviously gone until April and they came back to school. Mm-hmm. So I just rented it for the summer. My little cousins were out there and I just hung out with them every day. It was awesome. Mm. I had such a good time.
So that family, it was like family and friends? Like, were you feeling like you were just so far away for so long that you were just kind of losing touch with people? Or was it just...
I think I've always wanted kids and to start that family and to be close to home was important to me. I come from a pretty big family. When we have Thanksgiving, there's 70 people that show up. That's normal to me.
Yeah.
And I had went on this great adventure. It was sort of, I love Western Canada. I love Calgary. We're so lucky to live where we do. Mm-hmm. It was time to come home and grow up or evolve to that next level.
So after your kind of summer adventure, what are you thinking about during this time off? Are you worried about finding the next like master craftsman to kind of to work with, or what's occupying you?
Well, I had this harebrained idea. I called it, 30-day dreams. Turn your can'ts into cans, turn your dreams into plans. And what I was going to do was create content. So 30 days of content where you could get like a micro lesson in something really neat and funky. If you wanted to learn how to play the guitar, just commit to it for 30 days.
Yep.
5 minutes of content every day. And at the end of that 30 days, you'll have a good understanding or at least the conviction to buy a guitar and go take lessons. It was sort of that primer into all these fun things. Mm. And so I've always been I've always known how to develop a website, to spin up a server, to install WordPress, to do all the DNS, to build these crazy websites. I've always done that my whole life.
And was that self-taught? Out of just kind of interest, or was there something that triggered you to figure that out?
Self-taught. We had a computer kicking around the house. Yep. I'm from the MSN Messenger ICQ days.
Yeah,
so just, playing around on the computer was sort of what we did. And my family were all entrepreneurs. So I've been making websites, hilarious websites, you know, my whole life. And I still do. But that was sort of it. So in Kelowna, I realized like, hey, maybe an entrepreneur is cool. This would be neat. I had way too much fun in Kelowna for the summer to make it work and realized at the end of the summer, like, okay, I don't know enough yet to be an entrepreneur. I got to go get a job. Hmm.
Did you, so what was your move? Like, did you know what the next step was, or did you have an idea of what path you're going to go down?
Well, all the successful people, or what I deem to be successful people in life, had spent some time in sales, learning how to tell stories, learning how to convince people of value, learning how to ask people for money. Mm. All of these skills were things that I didn't have. So when I moved back to Calgary on my trajectory to one day start my own company, I thought, hey, I got to get a job in sales.
And this was part of the end goal is to start your own thing.
Well, I didn't really know it at the time. I think it was to start it,
but you saw some gaps in where your skill set was. And
I'm a fixer.
Yeah.
I'm not a marketer.
Yeah.
I didn't understand any of that. I had this 30-day dreams concept, thought it was super cool, but then I got to the point where it's like, okay, how do you get people to use it? And I have no idea.
That's details.
Not my jam.
Yeah.
I have never worked for a craftsman in that space, so... I came back with the realization of, hey, I got to learn this stuff. Sales, marketing, storytelling, conversations. That's super important.
Yep.
Where do I go to find that?
Hmm. So where'd you end up?
Went to a few places. So I started at a big company called Weatherford.
Oh, yeah.
They had sales training. I learned process. I got red coveralls. They had CRMs, all of that big business.
Yep.
Process, procedure. That was cool. Spent the better part of a year there.
Yep.
Left and went back to a smaller mud company because I understood it, could help them a little bit. that job where I sort of did a technical role, but also a little bit of sales was neat too. And then eventually ended up landing at a company called New Alta, which was an environmental service company. It was where I sort of came up with a thesis of what we do at Galatea. But that was a really neat company too. And I learned a lot. It was nice because it was sort of the middle between Weatherford, which was to the book process, everything documented, to that mud startup that I worked at, which was just do whatever it takes to get it across the line. It was sort of that happy medium, and I did amazingly well there. I had a lot of fun.
As you're working for these other companies, are you starting to process the idea of like, I'm seeing a gap in the market, or I'm seeing something or a process that could be done better? Are you like putting little checks in your back pocket, like, oh, that's an interesting insight?
In the early days, honestly, it was more about when I manage people, I'm never going to treat them like this, or this process is dumb. This could be better. Being that fixer, I walk into other businesses and I just have this innate, and it's not even ability, it's almost a curse to see where the friction is or to see where the complications are. I'm always trying to find that perfect optimization, that perfect system that just runs smoothly.
Yep.
So working at these big companies, it was more along the lines of realizing, hey, one day when I'm the boss, we're not going to do any of this. This is insane. Mm-hmm. Sales meetings, we're not doing that. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. So going through that process, when I ended up at New Alta, it was really where I stumbled along this huge opportunity. Very early on in my career, not even career, in life, I remember sitting on the couch with my grandpa, and he's this entrepreneur, land developer, doing a bunch of stuff all the time. And I always would say, like, Grandpa, how do you decide what you want to do and what you don't want to do? And he said, well, you got to find the things that are going to pay you a lot of money with the least amount of effort, and they're going to be fun. And if you can figure out what those are and only do those things, you're not going to do a lot of work. You're going to get paid a lot of money, and you're going to have a lot of fun. Okay, that sounds good. So all throughout my career, I've been trying to plot, you know, effort and return and find the opportunities that have the least amount of effort with the most amount of return.
Which is an interesting perspective, right?
Well, and the older I got, the more I realized everybody's looking for those opportunities. So if you do it in that quadrant, there's a whole lot of competition.
Yep.
If you find the ones that are really hard work, but a whole lot of return, that's where not a lot of people will dance with me. My superpower is outworking people. I'm not afraid to go up into that sort of quadrant. And there's a few of us around town that play there. That's really where you can create some cool businesses, because people look at the opportunity and they go, this is crazy. I'd never do that amount of work. But the reward, the upside, the value that you provide is massive. So it pays to really lean in and work hard on something.
It's interesting that your grandpa was like, his ideas kind of fascinating. It makes sense, obviously, from the outside. But do you think most people hear that, or most people approach business in that way?
Well, I think part of it with business is realizing that failure is okay. I have this really cool mentor that when you walk into his office, behind his desk, he doesn't have his degrees. He has bankruptcy certificates. And seeing my parents live through a failed business made me realize that at the end of the day, if shit hits the fan, I can still go back and get a job, or I can still go work on their rigs, all of these other things. So the worst case scenario, you go bankrupt in 7 years, it's cleaned up and you do it again. A lot of these really cool entrepreneurs have a couple bankruptcy certificates and live through it. Once you can put that into perspective and realize that that's okay, that's normal, then the perceived risk that you take on in business is exponentially lower. And you just get that conviction that, if I work hard and sit on top of this for a long time and be studious and mindful in the pursuit of mastercraft, the success will come. There is no overnight success. A lot of these amazing entrepreneurs like Darcy, they've been doing this for a really long time. And that's what it takes. You got to find that grit and tenacity to get there.
What happens after New Alta?
After New Alta.
Are you plotting at New Alta, or what are you doing?
Oh man, I had this crazy experience at New Alta where I came into the business to sell one thing and ended up selling all of those things. They're called centrifuges, piece of equipment that goes on the backside of a rig. They didn't have any more for me to sell because I had them all in the field. So I wandered around the office And I found a couple more things to sell. So all of a sudden I started selling filtration equipment, found this new thing called a thermal cuttings cleaner, sold that out. And then eventually I got to the point where I managed a bunch of facilities for them in Saskatchewan and Central Alberta. Mm. And I looked at the relationship between how much money was being spent on this process and how the decisions were being made, and realized that energy companies have been doing the same thing for so long. They're so antiquated, the processes. They still run these billion-dollar businesses in Excel on spreadsheets. That's okay. What I realized were the decisions, because of that, the decisions being made weren't optimized. You know, in Western Canada, we spend $6 billion a year on this one thing, trucking and disposal, and it was wildly inefficient. At that time, I had no idea how much, but my obsession around these perfect systems and these optimization really kicked in. Mm. And I said, okay, this is a big number, billions of dollars, and if you can save 10% of $1 billion, somebody will pay you a lot of money for that. And so I would go to all of my clients and friends and just talk. We'd go for lunch and we'd talk about this crazy idea and say, hey, I can make this better. Would you pay for it?
Mm-hmm.
And created the conviction to go to the next stage.
That, the selling piece, you got good at it? And what was the, was there some sort of like magic sauce that made you good at it?
Mm. So I think sales is all about being around people who are good salespeople and then stealing little tiny things about their persona, about the way they carry conversations, about their process, about their procedure, and then shaping it to be your own process. And over time, you constantly evolve that process and the execution to become better and better, and you understand more and you can create more conviction. It's managing relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the technical piece. I could walk into any room and pull up a spreadsheet and convince people on paper. I could talk through any field operation because I'd been there, I'd lived it.
Yep.
The things that made me a really good salesperson were learning how to listen. We're learning how to ask for the work.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a great relationship with somebody. You say, hey, on this next opportunity, can you make sure you include me?
Mm.
I'm a fixer. So when people say, Chad, I have a problem, I'll solve it for free because I love fixing things. Mm-hmm. What made me a great salesperson was realizing how do you maximize that monetary interaction and not leave any dollars on the table. I still have to work really hard on that today. Mm-hmm. But it were those sort of features and those attributes that I had to work really hard on, like a craft, and continually to get better and better at those.
Yeah.
It's sales is all about process.
Mm.
It's all about accountability. It's all about execution. Still to this day, I'll have amazing meetings with people and I'll just not follow up because I get so insanely busy, or I forget, or I send one email and don't get a response. The real amazing salespeople are actually executors. Mm. They just get into a process, get into a rhythm and follow up, have that accountability. I had to learn those things. And you do it by being around amazing salespeople and going to meetings with them and listening and watching what they do and then stealing little bits and pieces of that to craft your own sort of process.
Which is a different approach versus thinking that you have it, you know, that you're like go get mentored or study under or learn from someone who's done it better or longer.
And that's okay too. There's lots of amazing salespeople that have processes that you can sit in and you follow their playbook to a T.
Yeah.
You put things in the top and they come out the bottom of the funnel and you get a commission check and everything's great. I was sort of that craftsman, right? That person that liked the understanding and the science behind it and the relationships. How do you tell good stories? How do you create conviction? Mm. How do you create need and establish, is there a budget, who has the authority, all of those sorts of important things in sales. It took a long time to learn that. I'm still you know, a student of that craft.
So after you have those conversations with these people in your world about this idea, where does it go?
Well, I had understood the operations part. I've worked in the field. I've smoked cigarettes at the flare stack, so check. That one's off the list. Worked in New Alta, which was the receiver. But there's a truck in between them. There's a truck that would show up at the drilling rig and take the cuttings to New Alta. I never worked for a trucking company. So what did I do? Well, I convinced my wife there was a brilliant idea for me to leave my great paying job at New Alta while we had a brand new house and a couple of kids and join a trucking company.
Mm.
Yeah, it's great.
All very calculated though, right? Like, you know.
No, as much as it sounds like it's calculated, I was just figuring out as we go.
And but the idea of like, why'd you want to go trucking? Because you wanted to connect the dots between like
start to finish. I was curious, right? There was a lot of interesting things that happened.
Did you know somebody? I had
this sort of idea of a business and I went around to all the trucking companies and explained my idea. And this one person I met with was like, yeah, I think that's a really good idea. Why don't you come over here? You can sell. You can help us with some other software stuff and you can work on this idea. Mm. Okay, cool.
Which is an interesting approach, right? To actually tell somebody the idea.
Yeah.
Were you ever worried that somebody would take it and...
Listen, execution's my superpower. Mm. If you can come into my lane and out-execute me, you deserve it. In fact, the world will win because of it. Mm. I'm not afraid of execution. I will outwork anybody. And that's sort of my mentality. Mm. I'll give you my best five ideas right now because I hope one day you do them and I can subscribe or buy them from you. I think that's an important thing to do. And I've always been generous with what I'm working on and ideas because I've only met a few people who would outwork me. Mm. But working for this trucking company was really cool because I got to get back into operations, back into feeling it, living it, driving around in the trucks, going to the dispatch room, being in Grand Prairie. To solve a problem, you have to earn the right to solve a problem. You have to live that pain. You have to be that person. It has to be your problem and you need to spend a lot of time obsessing over it and what keeps you up at night. And it was a really awesome 2 years working for that trucking company because it was crazy. I went into it thinking some of the most, you know, wealthy, predominant families run trucking companies. You've got some amazing families here in Calgary that run these multi-generational businesses that have been around for so long. How hard could trucking be? And it's one of the hardest businesses out there. It was absolutely crazy. It's a balance sheet business where you're running expenses and you've got revenues coming in and they're always in this constant flux. There's small checks. To manage that was insanely hard. And it gave me this appreciation for, you know, all these trucking companies. There's hundreds of them in Western Canada that service the energy industry. It gave me so much appreciation for that. And after a couple of years, I had really thought I understood it enough and had the conviction to go out and start the business that we do today.
Hmm. Interesting. It's such a like a studious approach to starting something.
Yeah, it's the craftsman approach, right? Yeah. You've got to spend a lot of time sitting about it, thinking about it, architecting it in your mind. And then when you start cutting wood, it's totally different.
Yeah.
Everything changes and you just go through that pursuit of getting to perfection, which never comes.
Mm-hmm. The chase. So what did you decide to start?
Started a company called Galatea. Mm. Expert level timing. Started it the week before COVID.
Oh, I was just going to ask you on timing. So that was good planning.
Mm-hmm. That was really good. Also, not long after oil prices went negative. Another.
Yeah.
Yeah, really good thing for my business. We serve oil and gas companies. And it was a crazy period. We got some office space at a buddy who ran an engineering firm, posted up in the back and got our first client. And really, you know, one of my secrets is live the pain. So we actually used our own software on behalf of the client. So we were the user and that creates this rapid feedback loop to software. You increase the cycle time, you fix your own problems. When the phone rings at 2 a.m., you're picking it up, not your client. You go through this iterative process to just continually refine. And we've been on that loop now for 5 years.
What do you say that 5 years? Does it feel like it was just yesterday? Or does it feel like you've been at this for, you know, 20 years?
Well, I'm 19 years old and I look like I'm 50. It honestly, some days it feels like it's been 5 months. Other days it feels like it's been 50 years.
Yeah.
It's been such a cool process. In Calgary, our ecosystem, we are so lucky to have such amazing people that have leaned in to help build a business. Mm. It takes a community to build a business. And Calgary, with our energy industry, we've had this ecosystem of business building for so long. And it's nice to see that those people, that information, that wisdom cascade itself into my business, which is sort of on the fringes of energy and technology. I've met so many amazing people. I've had so many incredible conversations. The clients that we work for are phenomenal. Calgary is one of the best places to incubate a business and to be an entrepreneur. We're so lucky here.
What's been the biggest biggest learning for you since you started this? What's the, because, you know, as you've kind of worked your way through it, you know, you're learning things along the way. You've been kind of thoughtful around, like, how you're learning it, who you're learning it with, and what's been the thing that you, not surprised you, but the thing that's like, that you've really...
Every time I sit down with amazing people like Darcy or Mitch or all of these people that have created amazing businesses, I always ask, does it get easier? Mm-hmm. And I've never yet had somebody say yes. Everybody just says, Chad, it doesn't get easier. You earn the right to have more complex problems, but you get comfortable in it. You just get comfortable operating and solving problems. Mm-hmm. What used to, you know, when I think about highs and lows of your day, what used to be ultimate highs and what used to be like massive game-changing lows for me, I can ride that in the middle. Nothing, you know, I've learned to operate in sort of a Zen state where you don't get too excited about the crazy wins and you don't get too upset about the crazy losses. Yeah. You just kind of live in flux in the middle, in sort of that Zen state, and it's been awesome for me. Hmm.
Do you, growing up around it, you know, a bunch of entrepreneurs, you know, now that you're in it, you're 5 years in, does it feel like this is, all these years has kind of led to this moment? Like, does it feel very natural for you right now to be doing your thing?
Man, honestly, there's days I wake up and I remember my old sales job, not having the responsibility of running a business where you have employees. You know, there are truthfully days where I dream about going back to that and going like, oh man, that would just be so easy. I've got three little kids and the chaos of hockey and dance and soccer. Mm-hmm. I look at things like that, but I quickly realize I'm not that person. As easy as it sounds like it would be today, I would hate it. I wouldn't last very long. I like this. This is, people talk about work-life balance. I think that's the most insane concept ever. I don't have to worry about that because I love my job. Mm-hmm. I love the life I've built. I love the relationship I've got with my family. This isn't something that's an if or a then or a trade-off. This mm-hmm. is something that I've just integrated to have more good days and bad days.
Mm-hmm. That approach of like not really worrying about the... you know, I need a break, or it's like the weekend, you know, like when you're doing your own thing, it's, you're always on.
Yeah.
And there's a sacrifice to it, you know, whether it's, you're not fully in tune with who you're sitting with at a certain time, because there's something you're dealing with or thinking about or forward direction, whatever it is. That's a bit of a sacrifice, but better than the alternative.
Yeah. And I think it's a sacrifice to some people. It's just been normal to me my whole life. And I try to have those conversations with my kids. Like you said at the dinner table, did your parents have those conversations about building a business and that they understand it? I try to have that with my kids. Mm. I bring them to the office often. We talk about what I'm doing. Mm. I don't hide anything from them. We talk about raising money and why I'm going on, you know, a business trip to Toronto to meet with certain people, to let the kids know that that's normal. Mm-hmm. You know, when dad looks like his eyes are glazed over and rolling around in the back of the head, I try to talk to them about the problems that, you know, hey, we've got this really tough situation we're at work. What do you think we should do? Mm. And being able to have that conversation with an 8-year-old or a 6-year-old, hopefully when they get to be in their formative years, they think that's normal too. And that's something that when they get into the business world or they get into whatever they want to do in life, it's not the first time they're experiencing this. Mm-hmm. They've had those conversations at the dinner table that are super important, you know, their whole lives. When we have dinner with our kids, one of the things we talk about, and I encourage everybody to do because it's super cool, is when you have dinner with the kids, ask them, what's the best part about your day? What's the hardest part about your day? And to get them to socialize that that's okay to have those conversations and it's okay to talk about what's hard. Mm-hmm. It's okay to celebrate the wins. If you can do that and build that muscle with your kids, you know, that's going to create some pretty resilient kids when they get older. Mm-hmm.
You touched on this earlier, the mentorship idea. Have you been thoughtful of having people in your life that kind of have allowed you to move down this path at a certain clip? Or is it very situational where you just kind of come across a individual or a group that's like willing to help?
Yeah, I got a ride over here from one of my mentors. We spent a couple hours in the boardroom before this, and it was the exact conversation that we had. When you get into a situation as a leader of a company, everybody wants to give you advice. Mm. And that advice comes from everybody, you know, your management team, advisors, investors, directors, everybody around you. And that's a process of evolution as well. You need to evolve those people around you and find people that are willing to take you to the next level. That's super important. Mm-hmm. I'm that craftsman and I'm always looking for that next master craftsman. I've gotten that relationship with some of the biggest business builders in Calgary. Mm. But at some point, I'm going to have to grow that network even more to find people that are doing really world-changing things. Mm-hmm. Because we started to earn the right to have bigger problems. We started to earn the right to scale our business into the US, and not a lot of people have. We started to earn the right to have to hire and fire and go through all of this crazy stuff you do in business, and not a lot of people have. So I'm constantly trying to figure out who is that master craftsman that can get me to that next level, who are doing amazing things and executing insanely well. And being a good human, when you look at business, there's often sacrifices, and it's more about who you are as a person versus outcomes. I'm always trying to find those people who are amazing people and generate those incredible outcomes. That's the hardest thing to do. You have to learn how to be a coach, and you have to learn how to have that tough love and that relationship where we can have a real honest conversation about what matters. You know, I generally care about you, but I'm also going to hold you accountable. Mm-hmm. So I'm in the process right now of trying to learn and figure out, how do I become that leader, that coach, that person that people are willing to come to and be vulnerable with, but at the same time, I can hold people accountable.
Is this something new that you've been thinking about that you've like figured out you needed to learn and get better at? Like, do you get pushed into a corner and realize there's a gap in your skill set?
Yeah, I came across this incredible fellow who's been talked about a lot on your podcast, and he called me out on it. He said, "Hey, Chad, come with me. This is what I see, and this is what needs to happen. You need to learn how to be a coach." Mm. And he told me a story about how he had a hockey coach at the U of A named Claire Drake. You heard about Coach Drake?
No.
So Claire Drake is the only university hockey coach that's in the Hockey Hall of Fame. Coach Drake coached the U of A Golden Bears for years. Yeah. And at some point, the football coach went down and Claire Drake said, "I'll come in and coach this." He won a football title as a coach, had never coached, knew nothing about football. Mm. But what he was able to do is create relationships with players where you thought that you meant everything to Coach Drake and you would do absolutely everything for him, and he gave you the wisdom on how to be an exceptional person and build those relationships. So it was really profound to me, and he turned me onto this book called The Trillion Dollar Coach, which talks about a gentleman named Bill Campbell who was the coach in Silicon Valley. He coached guys like Steve Jobs and Eric Schmidt. He was on the board of Apple while he coached the Google executive team. So just a profound coach. And, and it's a really good book that teaches some strategies on it. But that's really the craft that I'm after, is learning how to be an amazing coach in the business arena. I think I went to this really cool AGM last week, and there was an ultra marathoner there named Lisa Bailey. She won 11 Ironmans while having cystic fibrosis, like an absolutely amazing human. Mm. And she said, great people make good people great. So I need to figure out how to make good people absolutely great. And that's the coach's role. That's sort of that next evolution of business for me.
Mm. Sounds like inspiring, fascinating, and just coaching people and like connecting with people is obviously what it's all about. So
yeah,
it feels like an interesting spot.
If you can figure that out, when you think about all these amazing people, we often think about athletes and musicians, but they're surrounded by teachers and coaches and instructors. they've got a lot of people leaning in and helping them get better. And early on in my career, I had to, like, being a 17-year-old kid on a rig, I was uncoachable, absolutely uncoachable. I just thought I was the coolest kid in the world. Over time, I had to learn how to become coachable. And that was really the first step in my journey towards being an entrepreneur, was figuring out, okay, if you can get the attention of an amazing craftsman, how do you learn how to be coachable? How do you learn how to be an apprentice? How do you learn how to listen? All of those sorts of things that go into that.
Would you have, now that you're on this path right now, you're like 5 years in-ish, would you have been able to get on this idea earlier? Or is this kind of the time, just based on a bunch of experiences, you're now ready, you're open to this idea?
I think of this more as, I'm not like this, the company's called Galatea. Galatea is part of my persona, but it's not my whole persona. I'm on this journey of learning how to be a builder of things and hopefully great businesses one day and amazing people. Galatea is a part of that for sure.
Yep.
It's been 5 years into this journey now, but at someday, hopefully we'll sell Galatea for a lot of money. But it's a journey. It's a never ending journey, and I'll walk the rest of my days trying to serve the craft and figure out, you know, what's that constant pursuit of perfection. And I'm sure there'll be something around the corner that I'm not privy to that, that will be sort of that next evolution as a leader.
That when people are like, even that key, you know, when you reference that keynote, you know, somebody says something that sticks with you, and obviously it fits the time with what you're thinking and what you're dealing with. The idea of like being vulnerable with somebody outside your organization, is that a natural thing to get to, or is it like, you know, the first couple of years that you're kind of like in a silo doing your own thing, and then all of a sudden you start looking up? These opportunities start presenting themselves and you got to be willing to acknowledge them.
Yeah, learning how to be vulnerable is one of the hardest things to learn. But once you start doing it, it's got some of the most profound reactions or responses back. I admire people who can be incredibly vulnerable, because I think it's a superpower that not a lot of us have. It's something I've worked really hard on, is that vulnerability in personal relationships with my wife, with my children, with my family, with the management team at Galatea, with advisors, mentors. I used to walk into relationships and I would be selling. I would be trying to convince them how amazing Chad is. And sometimes they'd nod their head. Lots of times they'd laugh. But what I realized was, if you can actually walk into those relationships and talk about the really hard things and commit to becoming better and going through that process, and you do that by being vulnerable, at the end of the day, you know, you're on this process of enlightenment, or you're getting better. I think vulnerability is a trait that we should be teaching people early on. And that comes with, it's okay to fail. That comes with, you know, getting away from social media, that instant gratification. If you think about Instagram or any of these social media platforms, that's the highlight reel. Being vulnerable is actually the opposite of that. It's actually, you know, being able to talk to somebody about the really hard times, being able to say like, hey, I go to therapy. I'm the same mortal that everybody else is through those situations. And that's how you really, you know, build a good life and build becoming a better person.
Yep. When you're looking at the biz right now, are you looking at like, do you plan it out 3, 5, 10 years, or is it, how do you approach the growth?
Oh man, it's the hardest thing. We're sort of, when you first start a company, it's like driving a gravel truck 200 kilometers down the gravel road, and you're doing everything you can to just to keep that thing. You're looking so near term, everything's short-sighted. There's things flying out the back. It's absolute chaos. You know, as you start to put better people around you, you get a co-pilot in that passenger seat that's telling you what's coming. You put some people in the back. You get a board on top of you that's saying, okay, here, you know, there's a hard right coming down the lane. You get some foresight. I'm sort of in that position now at Galatea where I can start operating on the business instead of in the business. I think that's an important place to be in, where I can let the business run by itself for a couple weeks, really see what's happening, where I need to jump in and fix, but also think longer term about that strategy. When we think about that, you know, I think Calgary has a wildly important role to play. The recent advancements in artificial intelligence, ChatGPT, the amount of electrons we're consuming as a company is gone exponential. Where does that energy come from?
Yeah.
When you think about a Google search, it consumes a small amount of data per Google search. It's an interaction between a server. When you think about a ChatGPT search, it's like 200 times the amount of information. As users, I don't think we understand the gravitas or the magnitude of energy consumption behind that. We're going to have to figure out how do we develop AI infrastructure. And thankfully, our federal government announced some funding in that space. But I think societies that can realize that AI infrastructure compute, the energy that comes behind it, the more security you can get in those facets, that's really what's going to determine first and third world countries. We've got an opportunity in Canada to lead that, but we need to put some effort behind it. And thankfully, Calgary, when you think about it, we're really good at infrastructure projects. We're really good at energy. We've got some of the most amazing talent in engineering. We care a lot about the environment and spend a lot of time around ESG. We're on pole to win this race. So I think it's something we need to take seriously, and I'm trying to steer Galatea into the tailwinds of sort of what I think the future looks like.
Cool. It's cool to hear, you know, as soon as you start going down that AI thing, I think that's an interesting conversation that people don't really think about, you know, the amount of energy it takes to have those prompts and to do all the things, like, just kind of take for granted.
Well, we're in inning one.
Yeah.
Like, it's just starting. You have companies like Microsoft coming out and committing $50 billion in infrastructure to data centers.
Yeah.
That's a really cool press release. $50 billion is a lot of money. I think of that as a big Amazon warehouse.
Yeah.
But what people fail to realize is that's filled with a bunch of chips. And every H100 or NVIDIA GPU that does this compute consumes an insane amount of energy. Which produces an insane amount of heat, which requires cooling and water. And what's that demand on society? Yeah. And at some point, do we have to have a conversation about, hey, would you rather have ChatGPT or electricity in your house? What does a brownout mean to you? All of these things that become really important, especially when you have kids. And, you know, if my lights went out for 3 hours every night around dinner time, that'd be really tough. And we're moving into a society that's consuming wildly more electricity than it ever has. How do we come to the table with clean energy, sustainable energy, secure energy? I think we've got a big role to play as Calgarians in that space.
Dude, it's like the perfect segue. Thanks for your time.
I appreciate it.
This is really cool to...
122.
Like 122, a real good number. Your segue is perfect because you know how I end this thing when I say Calgary, where's your head go?
Calgary is, you know, I love Calgary. When we think about what we are sitting on top of, I always say the plus 15. So downtown Calgary, all the buildings are connected on the second floor by this walkway. And I think that's our superpower as a city because that creates so many collisions. I spend time walking that plus 15 and I run into 50 people and they always say, Chad, how are you? What are you working on? And it always spurs to this never-ending conversation of working together. We're so lucky to be here in Calgary, working on really hard problems, trying to figure out a way where the world can have the same luxuries and same abundance that we live in Calgary. I'm all in on Calgary. I think this is going to be one of the best cities to live in North America over the next couple decades.
I agree. Before I let you go, the plus 15s, that's in your sales adventure.
Yeah.
That loop is, there's a lot of business done in those plus 15s.
Oh, and there's so many shortcuts and I know that thing like the back of my hand. Way. It's hilarious. I brought my kids downtown on a PD day. They came and worked with me in the office and then we walked to go meet mom for lunch and we were walking through the plus 15s and their poor little eyes are like, Dad, what's happening? We've been walking for like 5K. We haven't gone outside. And so I call it the mouse house. We're just a bunch of mice going around the mouse house. So my kids always ask now, it's like, Yeah, Dad, when are we going to the mouse house?
Thanks for your time, man. Really cool to meet you.
Hey, and I appreciate the conversations. I think Calgary has such an amazing ecosystem, and the more conversations we have like this, the more opportunities there will be for people to connect. I appreciate all the work that you do. I know 122 episodes isn't easy, but you're doing it. Keep going.
Work, man. You get it better than most, right? It's hard work. Thanks again.